it's from the ضروريات الشرع. Ghazali says from the necessities of the Sharia,
right?
Governance. Ibn Taymiyyah says that لا قيام للدين ولا للدنيا إلا بها, إلا به, that the there's no, you can't organize, you can't establish the deen or the dunya except with this pillar,
right,
of the deen. So it's given this significant importance.
The issue of the caliphate has recently made a resurgence within Muslim discourse. For nearly 100 years, the Muslim ummah has been without a caliphate, and many have come to view that the world of empires is behind us, and we now have to embrace an era of the nation state. Yet the issue remains a live one. Islam and Muslims have remained tortured by our lack of ability to resolve some of the most intractable problems we face, leading to the suggestion that establishing a post-nation state, bringing together our resources, our people, and our potential. My guest today, Dr. Uthman Badr, has been thinking about the concerns of the caliphate for some time. He's the lead editor at the Ummatics Institute. He received his PhD in philosophy from Western Sydney University in 2023, where he currently teaches. He is also an active member of the Muslim community in Sydney, Australia, with over two decades of engagement in grassroots activism and dawah. Dr. Uthman Badr, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to The Thinking Muslim here in Istanbul.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, thank you very much. It's an honor and privilege to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us today. It really is wonderful to see you after such a long time. Now, the issue of the obligation of the caliphate is a vexed one. Many contend that the caliphate is behind us. So I want you to set out the normative Islamic position on the caliphate. What is the case to say that the caliphate remains an obligation and has always been an obligation?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salam ala Rasulillah. Thank you very much. Very important topic, and I'm pleased to be part of the discourse on this. The caliphate as an obligation, normatively speaking, is to be honest, rather uncontroversial amongst Muslim scholars, classical, contemporary. That doesn't mean there aren't other aspects of the discussion around methodology and details and form on which there is a difference. There is, and that's to be discussed. But on the obligation and the concept and its part in Islam, this is rather uncontroversially accepted to be the case. The caliphate, it's probably worth starting off with a basic understanding of what we're talking about. The classical definitions around the caliphate are of two types, I would say. One is the idea that it is a general leadership, a general governance, we might say. So someone like Imam al-Juwayni and others define it as ri'asa 'amma, a general leadership, fi siyasati ad-dini wa dunya, to organize the affairs of the world and of the deen. And then other scholars have just said, well, that definition may also apply to prophethood. A prophet is a general leader. General here means without restriction, without qualification, of all people, and in most, if not all, matters. That would apply to a prophet. So others like Mawardi qualify this by saying it's in succession of the prophet. Khilafatun alan ani rasul. So basically, the Prophet ﷺ fulfilled certain roles. One of them was to receive revelation, and the other, we might say, was to execute or implement the revelation, to organize society at all its levels on the basis of the revelation. With his death, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the revelation stops, but that role to implement the revelation remains. And so that's in terms of the need for a leader to organize all of that. That's the role of the caliph, that's the role of the khalifa, the imam, the amir al-mu'minin. And as for its obligation as well, this is something that is virtually without dissent in the tradition. There is some dissent, but it's well, in the tradition, in Islamic tradition, or in the classical fiqh, we talk about mu'tabar and ghayr mu'tabar khilaf. So some difference of opinion is considered, literally. It's worthy of consideration, and others is not. In this case, the dissent comes from not even, like, I can't say the Mu'tazila or the Khawarij, but certain groups within, certain minority subsets of these heterodox sects. There was some dissent, people like Al-Asam, the Najadat of the Khawarij, these groups, which are not even known, to be honest. You have to name them for people to know. But otherwise, there's a very, to give an example, there's a very nice articulation of this from Ibn Hazm,
right,
who says that, you know, all of Ahl Sunnah and all of the Shia and all of the Mu'tazila and all of, like, he'll name the various sects, agree. And then he would just say, minus, you know, with the exception of these and these groups. So,
yeah.
It's an obligation. We can talk about the basis of that in the Quran and the Sunnah.
Please,
and
yes.
The discussion amongst the scholars as well. And of course, the scholarly literature. Maybe we can start there. You will find that if you preview the classical literature that deals with this topic, it comes up in a number of areas. And I would say primarily in three different subsets of the classical literature.
Yeah.
One is theological treatises, because it became an issue. A lot of the debates amongst the sects that arose in early Islam centered on issues of the imam, of the leader. Does he have to be fallible? Is he unfallible? Can he, you know, rebellion? So there was a lot of very real political issues of a political nature that gave rise to debates, and therefore the issue was addressed in theological treatises. Apart from that, it's also addressed in your fiqh literature, of course.
Yes.
Under the relevant chapters. So you'll come to a chapter on the hudud, or a chapter on rebellion, or a chapter on imara and imama, literally, and this will be discussed. And then you've got, as a subset of the fiqh literature, you've got specific writings on this topic, right? So, which is it's a smaller subset, but still there's quite a few works here, starting with Al-Mawardi in the middle of the 5th century, Hijri, Al-Juwayni, and others who write, in other words, specifically on this topic. So you've got fiqh manuals that are talking about everything, and they'll come to the topic, and then you've got treatises that are focused on this topic. All of them, the common point is they'll start off by saying, this is an agreed upon matter, this is an obligatory matter, this is something. Not only that, like, it's not just an obligation. Scholars will say things like, this is aham al-wajibat, the most important of obligations.
Really?
Yeah, it's a pillar. It's from the daruriyat al-shar'. Ghazali says, from the necessities of the sharia,
right,
governance. Ibn Taymiyyah says that la qiyama lid-din wa la lid-dunya illa biha, you can't organize, you can't establish the deen or the dunya except with this pillar,
right,
of the deen. So it's given this significant importance.
Can I ask, so why does he stress the difference between deen and the dunya? What's the emphasis he's making?
Well, because you
there?
Might think that this is something that's required by the deen, whereas the dunya can be organized otherwise. Or some might think the opposite terms, right? Some people may think along more secular lines, that if this is a matter of organizing political, economic, social affairs, it's not something to do really with the deen. And we actually got this view very late. Modern thinkers, starting with Ali Abdul Razak and others, took that type of a view.
Yeah.
But he's saying, no, it's both. The deen requires it and the dunya requires it.
Right.
And in a way, that's setting up enumerating these areas. But of course, we know that in Islam, that distinction is only for analytical purposes.
Right.
Otherwise, there's a coherence. And we don't, in origin, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that in origin, we don't make the difference or the distinction in secular terms.
Yeah.
So that there's this domain that is Islamic and this other domain. There is crossover, and there is, the two are inextricable in many regards.
Now, I'm trying to understand the debates about the obligation of the caliphate in the context in which we live today. I mean, I said in my introduction, we now have 100 years, or we're coming up to 100 years without commemorating 1924, the point at which the last Islamic caliphate was destroyed, or was dismantled. And many within the Muslim community have come to a view that maybe Islam can thrive without a caliphate. Make a case for why Islam is deficient. You know, you used Ibn Taymiyyah and Ghazali's quotes there. What is it about the deficiency that exists today in the absence of a caliphate?
That's a very good question. We can approach it, we can understand it in a number of ways. The first would be to say, you know, the cliche, the trope that Islam is a comprehensive way of life.
Right.
If it's a comprehensive way of life, which we take for granted, right, which means everyone understands this, you know, the child on the street understands, the Muslim understands it's comprehensive.
Yeah.
Then you can't have this, you can't have these divisions where governance, economics, and everything that comes with governance is somehow outside the purview.
Right.
Which is what it would mean if you say that that the caliphate or that governance, politics, however you want to talk about it,
yeah,
is auxiliary, is supplementary, is good to have.
Yeah.
Then you're putting these significant aspects of life outside the purview of the deen. And so obviously it's no longer a comprehensive way of life. The other way to understand it, I think, which is related, is that life is lived as a coherent whole. Again, even here, when we make distinctions between individual and collective, between public and private, between even between realms, social, economic, political, a lot of which are quite modern distinctions, by the way,
yeah,
as an aside, these are for analytical purposes in origin, and then for organizational purposes, for manageability, depending on the particular distinction. But otherwise, life is lived as a coherent whole.
Yes.
So, the reason I'm making this point is if we can approach this from a theological perspective, you know, Allah Ta'ala's sovereignty doesn't have a limit. And so, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says, مَا كَانَ لِمُؤْمِنِينَ وَلَا مُؤْمِنَاتٍ إِذَا قَضَى اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ أَمْرًا. When Allah is mentioned to decide on a matter, any matter, the believing man and the believing woman don't have a choice. But in other words, they submit. That's what makes them a Muslim.
Yeah.
Allah says, مَا أَتَاكُمُ الرَّسُولُ فَخُذُوهُ, whatever the messenger gives you. So in other words, there's no distinctions there between public, private, secular, non, you know, deen, dunya, these things. These are some, the Sharia and other texts will make certain qualifications, but in origin, they don't exist in that manner. And so Islam as a complete way of life, Muslims as people who submit to Allah, generally speaking, and not, you know, we follow the Sharia in these areas, but these other areas, we just do our own kind of thing.
Yeah.
Establishes that this is a matter that's part and parcel of the deen. And likewise, when we look at the case, if we come to look at the case from the Quran and Sunnah's perspective itself, you'll find that the issue of governance and the issue of the caliphate is almost presupposed. We can come to this now. I'm not sure if you want to talk about, because a common contention or a common question, contention, I guess, when it comes from the outside, Orientalists have raised this question, but some Muslim scholars, in more recent times, and common Muslims, the thought can come to mind about why there are not explicit evidences.
Let's talk about that, because we know that the common obligations in Islam, there'll be multiple texts that describe these obligations, right? And, you know, this is rudimentary. A Muslim studies in the madrasa at a very early age, and he'll find many ahadith and many Quranic ayahs about salah and about fasting. When we read the Quran, or at least a reading of the way we read the Quran, could be that, well, where is the explicit text that says you need to have imara, you need to have state, you need to have government? What's your take?
No, it's a good question. I think part one of the things that not well understood here, which sometimes give rise to this question, is that the Sharia and the Wahi and Islam in general is not an abstract philosophy. So the form in which the commands and the principles and the morals come speak to concrete realities.
Right.
And so if something is completely new or significantly new, like salah, it will come in multiple times, it'll be explicit. And that will also indicate its priority.
Yeah.
When we talk about governance, first of all, there are sufficient texts to which you cannot read in their totality in any other way to say that this is a necessary part of the deen.
Yeah.
Let me say that.
Give me an example.
Well, the example that the scholar will start from is the ayah that says, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu atti'u Allaha wa atti'u Rasula wa ulil amri minkum, oh, you believe, obey Allah and obey the messenger and those in authority amongst you.
Okay.
And so there are people in authority. and they need to be obeyed, and this in the context of Sharia and the Sharia being applied, so on and so forth. So very clear. And then obviously there are other ayat that are not speaking about explicitly about Imara, but it's just presupposing it.
Right.
So ayat about war and ayat about peace and ayat about punishments, for example, hudud punishments. Ayat that enunciate ahkam, rulings, which it's clear and there's no difference of opinion that these are not applied by individuals. They're applied by an authority, a political authority.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes this is the idea, and I want to come back to the point about the concrete reality to which the revelation speaks. Sometimes it's understood or it's assumed that being explicit somehow makes it more important than if it's presupposed. But presupposing something is a way of articulating the importance of it.
Right.
It doesn't need to be said. This is so clear.
Right.
That's when you presuppose something, right? So if we look at this from, let's say, a very fundamental ontological would be the technical word. I'm trying to avoid technical terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, philosophers debate the existence of the external world, right? Mm-hmm. The revelation doesn't at any point say, you know, the trees around you and this and stuff is real. It's not something else. It's just taken for granted.
Right.
It's presupposed. It's part of the fitrah.
Yes.
Right. And that's a different level of presupposition, but it's not correct to assume that something which is presupposed is less important. In a way, it's not being explicated because it's so clear.
Yeah.
Now, but why is that taken? If you think about it, the Prophet ﷺ, when he came to Mecca, and when the revelation starts, it's a tribal society. And so something new is going to take place, which is that the Sharia is going to enunciate the idea that you can have these tribes, but you need a central leadership as well. So that is enunciated. But what happens is the Prophet ﷺ is the central leader.
Right.
And so prophethood and governance come in one. Okay? And so everyone is told to obey him. To obey him, to give allegiance to him, to follow him, and it's wrapped up. The prophethood and the imam is wrapped up. Mm. The question of the imam only arises after the passing of the prophet.
Right.
Now, in this respect, first of all, there are numerous ahadith in which the discussion of the imam, the mention of the imam is made, right? Innamal imamu junnah. The imam is a shield. You fight behind him and you seek protection with him. They will come after me, the Prophet said, they will come after me, imam. Some will be good, some will be good. Numerous, like tens, if not hundreds of ahadith that mention the imam. The Prophet instructing us to give allegiance to one after another.
Right.
You can't have two, you have to have one, right? But nevertheless, in the age of wahi, the Prophet is the leader. And so he's not given the title of the imam, he's the Prophet, mm-hmm. the Nabi, he's the Rasul. Mm-hmm. And the explicit coming or the advent of the imam comes after him, okay? And it comes, and again, this is, think about the time when the Prophet passes away. The discussion that the Sahaba have, and there is debate and there's some controversy, is about who is going to take that role.
Right.
There is no discussion about whether we can just bypass this and not have a leader. And in fact, the scholars, when they discuss these in the treatises that I mentioned, this is a point that's oft made. There was no debate about whether we need to have one or not. Mm-hmm. The debate is on who it's going to be. I think there's one part where the Ansar in Bani Saqifah, they say, well, why can't we have one for you and one from us?
Yes.
But even there, no, it's not to say, you know, governance can be foregone. Let's just live our Islam, right? And leave the issue of governance. The decision is one from us, one for you. But straight away, Abu Bakr cuts that down and says, you can't have two. It has to be one.
Yeah.
All right? So the debates are around those particulars, but there's no debate on the question of that we need to select someone who is going to be the general leader and organize the affairs in this way. But yeah, it's literally taken for granted, apart from the various texts that mention it, and these are the basis of the scholars all saying it's an obligation, right? So anyone who has this question or objection that it's not explicit really needs to contend with why the scholars are, by consensus, saying it's an obligation. Where are they getting that from, if not the Quran and the Sunnah? So I think that needs to be considered as well.
Is the obligation to have some form of political authority, or does the obligation specify the need for a caliphate?
Okay. Now, if we take caliphate there as a particular name, we're talking about the word itself, then not necessarily.
Right.
But if we take the caliphate to be the label for the Islamic or the Shari'i form of governance, then yes. In other words, the Sharia says you need governance, but it then goes on to talk about certain parameters of that governance. So it's not like you need governance, can be anything, you know, take it from Rome, take it from the Byzantines. It's not like that, right? No one argues that.
Right.
It's you need governance and here are the basic parameters. So for example, the governance is meant to govern by the Sharia.
Right.
Okay. So if we enumerate just the fundamentals, even leaving aside the details, and we refer to that as Shari'i governance, Islamic governance, and that's what we give the name the caliphate to, then yes, we're talking about the caliphate.
What's the difference between the Pope in Rome in the pre-modern era and the Caliph of Islam? Is there a distinction? Is there a separate? Is there a difference between the two positions?
Oh, absolutely. Predominantly because Christianity in its formative phase, in its early years, in the years in which its political theory or its theory around governance forms, you do have a clear separation between the temporal authority,
right,
which is in Rome, well, they're both in Rome, but which is with the emperor, and the spiritual authority, which is with the Pope.
Okay.
So in other words, you have this very clear distinction between two authorities, and then there's a long theological debates around how they work together, who's on top, who accounts who, which is in the early church. And later on, I had to study a lot of this because of my dissertation, because this formed part of the history of secularism and the development of secularism.
Yes.
Because of that, there's a difference. So, but that's a good way of describing that difference and showing where the difference is, where in Islam, both those authorities come in one. The Khalifa is both the spiritual and the religious and the temporal authority at once,
right,
which reflects Islam's not making that so sharp a distinction between the two. That's not to say, I know there is some quarters and some scholars there's concern, which is understandable in the 20th century, of totalitarianism.
Yes,
right. That this is totalitarian. It's like what? So every single aspect of our life is governed in that way. But I mean, Muslims understand that in origin, yes, Allah's sovereignty doesn't have a limit and the Sharia doesn't have a limit. That doesn't mean that it comes to tell you the specific details of every single thing that you do in life. There are areas, let me be clear, there are many areas in life where the Sharia basically says, you decide.
Right.
This is a matter of expertise. This is a matter where, you know, you need to understand the particular reality, economic, social, political, you know, our analytical distinctions. So there's a lot of room where human thinking is not only allowed but encouraged to flourish.
Yeah.
But the point is, the Sharia will decide what those areas are. It's not a case of, you know, if I think of it in terms of, let's say, cups, our two thinking Muslim cups. It's not a case where here are two different domains. Sharia is here, spiritual, religious, and temporal, right? It's rather that, and somehow this temporal domain is self-defined or it's defined by some other parameters. No, the Sharia will determine, will it define this for us? And we'll tell us, here are the areas in which human thought and rationality is to flourish and things to be left. And the Sharia won't tell you the answers. Allah won't tell you that he knows everything. He's not going to tell you the answers there, right? Work them out.
Yeah.
Empirical areas, study, sciences, lots of areas. So I think that's important, because some people do think that, you know, they've got this understandable paranoia with totalitarianism.
Yeah.
But although we want to learn from experiences of the 20th century, you don't also want to import foreign experiences and assume that we have the same problems as what has taken place in the West.
I want to ask you about that from a historical perspective, but also what we can learn from the West, if we can learn anything. I mean, liberalism, you can say, you know, a very important component of liberalism is to try to understand the pathology of power absolute power destroys absolute power. Authoritarianism is a, you know, the overreach of the state is a very problematic idea in liberalism. Now, a Muslim living under the caliphate's of old, what would be his or her relationship with the state on a day-to-day basis? Will the state have a very direct impact on their lives, right down to, you know, their the laws in which they have to abide by, is centrally deduced by, you know, a caliph sitting in Istanbul or sitting in Baghdad? Like, what is that relationship? In modern states, there is a very strong relationship between the citizens and the leader. Was that the way in which the caliphate transpired in Islamic history?
Okay, there's a couple of questions there at least, and let's unpack it.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the as you were asking, I was thinking, there's an interesting juxtaposition or an interesting reality here where you're right, liberalism has this concern about power and the excesses of power, but at the same time, it's the modern liberal state which is whose power has seeped so deep.
Absolutely.
Right? So there's something of an irony or a contradiction there. But when we talk about the caliphates of old were not, I mean, in terms of the reach of the state, it was limited, naturally. It's not just the caliphate. The empires of old had limited reach.
Yeah.
In terms of their ability to do that, but also in terms of whether they wanted to. I mean, we have got a new philosophy with the modern state, the secular state, and how much it tries to refashion the world and how deep it goes.
Yeah.
Caliphate of old didn't do that. Islamic caliphate power was diffuse, decentralized in many respects.
Yeah.
Some because of technological limitation, but others just because of that's how it's set up. So, that's how it developed. Mm. It's set up and developed, right? So, for instance, a lot of power rests with the ulama.
Okay.
Because by definition, the caliphate is a Sharia-governed state. But who are the interpreters of the Sharia, right? Who are the gatekeepers of the Sharia? It's not everyone. Scholars have a frontline role.
And could be scholars in different regions have differences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right. And then there's another layer. There's a number of layers here.
Yeah.
Another layer would be the fact that so much of the Sharia is open to interpretation.
Right.
In fact, the vast majority of the Sharia is open to interpretation, which means there's room for multiple readings and multiple interpretations within limits.
Right. So the Khalifa would enable, I mean, is this within, like, the picture you're painting, is that just the preference of most of the caliphs of the past, or is there something within Islam which mandates that the caliph should only apply or only implement a central law when it's very required?
That can be argued. So this is where there's a debate.
Okay.
There's different views. And again, we would have to talk about particular aspects, as I what I refer to as the layers. So
right.
The difference of opinion is built into the Sharia, so to speak. The nature of the texts, the way they've been articulated, the way they've been revealed, is that they have an interpretation, which means that was the maqsood, that was the objective, to leave this room open and therefore to allow for multiple manifestations of how we pray and how we fast and how we do anything, really.
So the caliph wouldn't interfere in those religious aspects.
It wouldn't interfere in those aspects.
Yeah.
Definitely in the sort of ibadat, they wouldn't do that. And in fact, when they did that, even with, say, theological debates, the result wasn't good.
Right.
So we have the mihna as an example, amongst others. So some things are definitely within the structures of the Sharia, if you will. Other aspects, there are historical realities, right? So when I made the distinction, when I said that power was diffuse because scholars have a significant role and scholars are not in power.
Yes.
That fact is a historical contingency. It's how history unfolded.
Okay.
All right. Qadar Allah.
Yeah.
If we go back to the model of the early Rashidun, it's not like that. Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and Ali are, you know, scholar par excellence and ruler par excellence in one.
Yes.
And And I think most, if not all scholars would agree that that is the model.
Right.
In principle, that's the model. The details and the forms obviously change over time, but in principle, that's the model. So it's a fact of history. But it could be argued that, you know, this, if you look at Islamic history, the global view, that's 30 years compared to the next 1200 or 1300.
Yes.
Right. So we could, it could be argued that historically that model has a much harder feasibility. So it operates more as a, what we call a regulative ideal,
yeah,
or an asymptotic ideal, right? Which is that you're meant to aim for it, but historically we know that you're not, more often than not, you're not going to achieve that. And so power will be diffuse. Some will be with the authorities, some will be with the scholars,
yeah.
Some will be with influential people in society.
Yeah.
And then as a matter of preference, you will get different views about whether more centralized or less centralized, what's better. And this is where we can have a debate. We can learn from history.
So can we learn from the West?
Yeah, we can. We can learn from the West as well, in certain areas as opposed to other areas. And the distinction I made earlier between or the fact that the Sharia leaves certain areas, it defines and then leaves certain areas of human life for human thinking and human rationality and understanding of reality, empirical study. In all those areas, we can learn from the West as opposed to norms, morals, ahkam, which we take from the Sharia exclusively, but in all these other areas, historical experience, what thing works, what things work, how they work better, we can definitely learn from the West. And this takes me back to your question about liberalism. We know that liberalism in the current age is its influence on Islam and the Ummah is by and large problematic, and we need to be wary of that and push back and the rest of it. But when we think from this perspective, from an intellectual academic perspective, as scholars learning from human experience, liberalism is no different than any other human form of ideology, way of life, political theory, right? Which means that it will have things we can learn from. It will have things that we will look and say, you know what, that's good. And for instance, if you look at medieval or pre-modern societies in terms of the political activism or the political participation of common people, and you compare that with the modern times, we can see an element of progress.
Right.
Because whether it be the caliphates of old or whether it be the empires, European empires, other empires of old, large numbers of the masses had nothing to do with. They were just almost completely divorced from what's happening in the center, right? Now, that's a historical fact, but if we think about this from, you know, we take the norm from Islam, what does Islam say? Should people be involved or not?
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that I think a lot of people involved in work for Islamic governance, Islamist spaces, discussions, conversations, will say that people should be involved, right? To one extent or another.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, the democratic move that takes place in modernity, although obviously clearly we disagree with the ascription of sovereignty to people at large, but otherwise the empowering of the masses, to other extent, it's been deficient, right? Obviously, we know that to many extent, one aspect of this that people participate in nominal ways, but there's an ideal.
Active citizenry,
yeah. You know, being an active citizen, participating, having concern, that ideal is a good thing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so you can learn from these experiences, certain ideas will be closer to what we have, but it's just that we haven't been able, at least in the last 100 years, we've been away from power. And so, yes, you can learn from Western and other experiences.
So let's return to the discussion about obligation. Now, when we think about obligations in Islam, you know, I suppose we think about obligations as personal and achievable. The obligation of the caliphate, which you've described very well, seems to be beyond our achievable abilities. How much are we accountable today for the absence of a caliphate?
That's a very good question, and also one that I think gives rise to certain misunderstandings about the priority of this work and the priority of the topic. And I think what's underlying this is just an understanding of the difference between communal and individual obligations. So you said that when we think about obligations, we think about them in terms of them being personal and achievable.
Yeah.
That's true of individual obligations. It's not true of communal obligations.
So these are fard ain.
Fard ain, yeah. Fard kifaya, okay. is the technical terminology.
Yeah.
So fard ain, yani the obligation that applies to individuals,
okay.
each person, and the kifaya, fard al kifaya, is the obligation of sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Communal, basically, it means it's a communal obligation, and therefore some people can carry it out. Not everyone has to get involved necessarily.
Okay.
And so the point is that the premise to that line of thinking is speaking about individual obligations, but it's applying that to all sorts of obligations.
Yeah.
And so what helps here, I think, is to think about other communal obligations that we accept, right? Mm. One would be to do with jihad, the war and peace, but that also becomes a bit abstract now in our current situation.
Yeah.
Knowledge is another one. Ijtihad is another example.
Okay.
Ijtihad is a fard kifaya. For the vast majority of the ummah, they really can't do anything in that realm, right? So it applies to scholars, even then a sort of subset of scholars, and so on and so forth. So the point would be that, yes, obligations need to be achievable, but when we're talking about communal obligations, we have to start thinking about them as a community, as an ummah. Okay. So now if we're thinking, and so it's a different register of thinking, and we need to do that. This is, I think, part of the problem here is the seeping in of a sort of liberal atomistic type of thinking, where we're thinking as individuals. We're thinking on an individual level almost always.
Yeah.
Right? And that's understandable because the collectivity, this is tied to the dissolution of the caliphate, because with the dissolution now, what establishes that the communality or the community in concrete terms is dissolved, right? And so, and then obviously you've got migration and Muslim diasporas, and we still obviously have, I'm not saying we don't have any elements of community, we do the ibadat community, we have Eids and Ramadans and whatnot, but the societal elements, the stuff of economics and the stuff of governance and all that stuff has been severed. So communal obligation, we need to think in the register of the community. And so the question becomes, is this achievable for the ummah? It's no longer the question, is this achievable for me and Jalal and, you know, a small subset, or for the scholar? Is this achievable for the ummah?
Yes.
And at that level, I would say, yes, it is achievable. Is it going to happen tomorrow? Probably not. Is there a lot of work to be done? Yes. But think about it in these terms. Does the ummah have the resources, the talent, the ability to take its own affairs in its hands in the Muslim world? Of course it does. Right? When you put it in those terms, like, to say no would be really to enter into, subconsciously or unconsciously enter into Islamophobic tropes, which is what make possible the thought that Muslims are somehow deficient. Other people, Westerners, can, you know, organize their society. They can deal with power and governance and, you know, but Muslims, no, we can't do it. Why can't we do it? Of course we can do it. So I don't think any self-respecting and aware Muslim would argue at this level that it's not possible. It's possible. The question then becomes, well, what needs to be done?
Right.
What's the work? How is it to be done? You know, where can different people contribute? Does everyone have to contribute? You know, is the lay Muslim and the scholar or the academic at the same level in terms of what they can do? All of that, I think, is the second level. But the starting point really has got to be thinking at the register of the ummah and thinking, can we do this as an ummah, and being very clear that, yes, we can.
So let me get that straight. In the same way, say, for example, there is a need for a group of people within a community, within each community, to have a scholar who can extract the dalil, extract the hukum from the dalil, the ruling from the dalil, or a group of Muslims who take it upon themselves to bury the dead in the community. And so you professionalize it, and you hire people who would do that. So not everyone is engaged in that work, but a group of people are doing it. But Ummah, the community, need to invest in, need to help, need to assist in creating groups of people who are thinking seriously about this matter. Is that what you're saying about the kifaya?
Yes. In origin, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a fard kifaya, and what you said applies to all fard kifayas.
Okay.
That's why they're defined in that way.
Yes.
Literally, kifaya means from kafa, it's sufficient. Right? So it's an obligation that, first of all, Allah Ta'ala has not associated with every single person or with specific individuals, but rather with a specific subset of people who are more relevant to it. But in origin, it's on the ummah.
Right.
So it's on the community.
If for example, let's talk about those who are capable in a second, but let's say, for argument's sake, those who are capable were not engaging in this work, then the responsibility of the entire ummah would be to develop those capabilities or develop those people, to help those people, to give money to them, to set up, you know, institutions for them so that they could seriously take it upon themselves to engage in this work. So let's then talk about who has the capability. Like, in your mind, who is most, maybe I'm phrasing this wrong, but who is most obligated to think seriously about the caliphate?
Okay, just before we come to this question, I had something else to before we miss, just so there's a structure to the discussion.
Sure.
I was saying that the caliphate is like all other obligations, all other kifaya fards, fard of kifayas. There is one sort of thing that needs to be added there, I think, which is that our reality post the caliphate, and particularly 100 years later, attaches to this a sense of urgency and priority that otherwise may not be there.
Right.
So in other words, we've already said, the scholars say, this is a very important thing. This is a pillar of the deen. Mm-hmm. This is a necessity of the deen. That's always the case, right? But the distinction that I think I'm thinking of here is, let's say 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago when Mawad is writing, and he's talking about the obligation. He's talking about in a certain different sense. And a very good point, a very important point comes up here that he mentions explicitly. Mm-hmm. He actually says, which is what we're talking about, right? So he says, it's an obligation. It's a fard kifaya. Mm-hmm. Then he says, but who does it apply to? Who's the mahkum alayhi, right? Who does the hukum apply to? And he actually says, this applies to two groups of people only.
Uh-huh.
Two groups of people. One, the eligible candidates, those people who are eligible to become the imam, right? Like, this is concrete. This is fiqh, right? Fiqh is concrete. Mm. It's like, there are a certain subset of people in the center of power in Baghdad, say, for example, at the time, who are going to be considered to be the imam.
The nobles, the political elites.
Yeah. Even there'll be people within them who will be, because it's a particular role.
Right.
And then the second group is the Ahl Halli wal Aqd, the influentials who will choose, who will appoint the imam. So in other words, he's delimited this quite a bit. He said, there's a certain, you know, there's people who are eligible for the imam, and then there's these people who will appoint him. He then literally says, the obligation is on them. And if they delay it, he actually says, if they delay it, the rest of the ummah is not accountable in these terms. Now, the thing is that he's speaking in a certain reality where what he's talking about is succession of the imam.
Right.
The system is in place, right? The system, the khilaf is in place. The institutions are in place. The qadi, the chief qadi, the qudat are in place. You know, in other words, a polity, a governance, a system is a complex entity.
Right.
It's got various arms and various institutions. They're all in place. What we're talking about here in this context, and in most of the literature that I mentioned earlier, the fiqh manuals, and they're talking about this reality. They're not talking like the dissolution of the caliphate is not a concrete possibility. Is it a rational possibility? Of course, it's not a concrete possibility, right? And the indication of that is, you don't have, there's almost, it's very difficult to come across scholars discussing this as a reality and what would happen and what ought to be done. Juwayni comes the closest in Ghiyath al-Umam, where he throws up certain hypotheticals about what would happen if there's no imam, and then what would happen if there's no scholars either. And it's very insightful work from that perspective. But even there's not an explicit discussion of if there's no imam, what do we do in order to reestablish the imam? Anyway, the point being that the classical scholars are discussing this matter in a particular context.
Right.
Right. And so what Mawardi is saying and what others after him, the Shafi'is generally are saying, I would argue that this is to be understood in this sense that it's about appointing the Khalifa when the system is in place. And even then, in origin, the obligation like ijtihad will be on scholars. It's not on lay people. Like, what's the lay person going to do?
Yeah.
Right. However, if this group doesn't do anything, then yes, others, it's not that the others will then stand up to take their place, but you have a duty coming out of a separate fard kifaya, which is to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, to push these people to say, what are you guys doing?
Right.
We, you know, this is an accountability that we have on our back. So now what happens when the Khilafah is dissolved, however, in the 20th century is now be different.
Right.
Our task today is not to appoint a Khalifa.
Yeah.
It's to reestablish we're starting almost from a blank page.
Right.
In many ways, more analogous to the Prophet's example in Mecca than to anything that happened in medieval times. In that area now, the roles become a bit broader, more people are involved, but it's still going to be a certain subsets of the ummah.
So who that are, in the ummah would
okay. be? So I think even here, it's important to think about the task first before talking about who would do it. Because we need to know what are we talking about? And sometimes I think this is also a problem where we kind of aggregate the idea. We've got this very broad idea. It's okay, working to establish the caliphate or Islamic governance, and it's like this blob. And it's like that, and then it's obviously going to feel very difficult. It's going to sound very, very tough. The first step, I think, needs to be to disaggregate the particular tasks that are involved into broad areas and then obviously subdivisions and the rest of it. When we do that, then we can talk about it. So, for example, what are the areas? I would suggest that I can think of at least three broad tasks, buckets, if you will, that are areas of work that we need. For example, number one, and this is not in order of priority, but number one would be intellectual work, academic work, ilmi work that tackles the question in creative and, you know, daring ways that are both, working with our tradition, starting with the tradition, but, you know, learning from knowledge that we spoke about earlier, from others' experiences, from modern knowledge that we can take from to answer the questions of what the caliphate looks like in the modern world.
Right.
What does Islamic economics look like? What does social policy look like, right? How can we imagine the forms of Islamic governance in our time?
Yeah.
Knowing that historically the forms changed, the forms evolved over time. They weren't always the same.
Right.
So in other words, it's like any other area of the Sharia, there's fundamentals, there's fixed matters, and there's a lot of matters that will evolve and change. So there's a lot of work to be done there. Now that's intellectual work. Who's going to do that? Intellectuals, scholars, right? Academics, thinkers in the broad sense.
Yeah.
Right? That would include both ulama in the sense of scholars of the Sharia. There's a big role there, but also academics with the area experts, as we call them.
So let's just, flesh that out a bit. So at the moment today, we live in a world where we live in a globalized world. We have an economic system which we can broadly describe as capitalist. Muslim scholars and thinkers have to develop a model of Islamic economics in view of the world in which we live, sticking to our principles, of Sharia, but at the same time, you know, aware that a caliphate should be responsible for the general well-being and the wealth of its people. So this requires economists, scholars who are versed in Islamic economics, but as well as that, Muslim economists.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and Muslims, so scholars of Sharia, who, and ideally you want people with both expertise.
Okay.
Otherwise it becomes sort of siphoned off. Yeah. But yeah, in other words, scholars of Sharia, economic experts, people who understand economics.
Yeah.
Not only that, people who understand political economy, sort of the philosophy behind economics.
Yeah.
Because again, economics is just a lot of these categories are modern categories.
Mm.
The idea of economics doesn't exist pre-modern. No. It's not there.
Yeah.
Although Aristotle spoke about oikonomos, it's a different context altogether, in a different worldview altogether. Now, so you need these experts and in broader fields to come and think about these questions. And you're right, there are fundamentals.
Mm.
Sharia will tell us you need this, this, and this. Riba's haram, for example.
Yeah.
Right? But the work we need, again, is at a few levels. So, you know, fiqh, generally speaking, whether we're talking about governance or any other area,
yes,
it's the task of fiqh to deal with the concrete realities of the time.
Right.
Right? You have to deal with them. You have to, okay, here's the starting point. Here's what we got. How do we go from what we want? How do we go from what we have to what we need? Right? And how do we work with that? So we need the ideal economic models, right? But because of how radically things have changed in modernity, how important economics has become, for example, and how different the forms are, Islamic economics is going to look different to what it did in pre-modern times.
So we can't just rely on economic texts or texts that may have discussed economics in some shape or form from history.
We can't copy paste them.
Okay.
They are part of an important part of the conversation.
Right.
In many ways, there'll be a starting point.
Yeah.
We'll look to see, and in fact, there'll be a learning point more than a starting point. Starting point with the Sharia.
Hmm.
But for the empirical side of things, there'll be a learning point to see how, for example, someone like Ibn Khaldun or other medieval scholars, Kitab al-Kharaj, Abu Yusuf, in the Hanafi Madhab, how they were dealing with the changed economic realities of their time.
Right.
Right? Things moved, what did they do? So you learn from that.
Yeah.
But what we need is not copy-pasting, we need to do what they did.
Okay.
We need to redo what they did. Scholars need to redo what they did.
So let's move beyond the experts, those thinkers, those intellectuals that you describe. Who else needs to do?
Yeah, so okay, one clear task, one bucket
is
intellectual work, academic work, ilmi work, let's say.
Mm.
Another area that I think is rather clear is what we might call activist or da'wah work.
Mm.
Okay? Why? Now, why? Because, and this is just a matter of thinking structure in a sort of structured manner. We need the models, but if I have the model, let's say I've worked out a significant part of the models, now what? That's just intellectual output.
Yeah.
It's in the books. It's ink on paper.
Right.
How's it going to transfer to the real world?
Right.
So now you need work out there that convinces people that we need to implement this stuff.
So these are advocates for
advocacy, work, activism. There's different words that we can use.
Yeah.
Dawah in Islam, enjoining the good, forbidding the evil.
Yeah.
But even here, I think it's helpful to think about the people that we're trying to convince at two levels, right? And all these categories. This is a contribution to the conversation.
Sure.
These are not fixed categories anyway. At two levels. Number one, certain people have more influence in politics, in economics, certain people are movers and shakers in the world. Khawas, right, in classical Islamic terminology. And other people, the awam, common people, don't have that much influence, okay? So there will be a difference here. In other words, if I want to, I'm thinking about how I can move to execute certain models that I've come up with.
Yeah.
Clearly, people in the political class, politicians, rulers, other intellectuals who may not have been with me in working this stuff out, leaders, we could use that terminology, right, are going to be more influential.
Yeah.
So in other words, this dawah work, this activism work or this advocacy work will be needed to be done amongst influentials, let's just use that for now, and amongst the common people,
right,
more broadly, let's say, in the ummah. And even outside the ummah. So now we've got two other levels, right? So people have to do this. Soon now, the point of doing this would be when we talk about who the obligation applies to, we can now ask the question of who has the capability to do this.
Okay.
Clearly the intellectual work, the capabilities with intellectuals, but not just the people who are scholars, students. up and coming students, people who have the talent to become the students, right? And so it will be difficult to close this off, okay? But nevertheless, we can think about it in concrete terms. And then at the second bucket that we've described in terms of advocacy, a wider group of people can do this, right? Some people are very good at intellectual work. They're not good with people.
Yeah.
They haven't got good social skills. They're not good at, as advocates. Other people are good as advocates. Some people can do both, right? So there is, in other words, there'll be intellectual work, there'll be advocacy work, that will work. And I think that would really be the main two areas.
Okay.
I said three, I think, originally, but because I'm subdividing the two.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I think it's an important distinction to make between advocacy work amongst influential people and advocacy work amongst the wider people in the Umma and outside the Umma.
So let me understand this from a perspective of an ordinary Muslim. He may live in the West, he may live in a Muslim world. Let's not make a distinction at this stage. An ordinary Muslim who has life's concerns, but also very basic obligations they've got to meet, obligations towards their family and their community. And of course, in many ways, Muslims have got the backs of a wall. We've got issues, intellectual issues within our community where we feel that Islam is being challenged in a way today, in a very rigorous way, in which many of our younger generation are somewhat leaving Islam, or at least they are disconnecting from the deen. So with all of these challenges and issues in front of us, how should an ordinary Muslim, so let's talk about this third category that you referred, how should an ordinary Muslim weigh up the obligation of caliphate, which is a sort of obligation that's out there, a kifaya obligation, and those immediate problems they face?
It's a good question. And I can see a concern that is a very valid concern behind it, that the idea that this work somehow monopolizes our concerns and everyone has to be involved and that type of thing, which is to take the very correct obligation priority, but to manifest in a certain way, which I think is problematic. Okay, there's a few points. Number one, the fard ayn has priority for everyone.
Okay.
Okay, so individuals have to get their fard ayn in order. But beyond that, everyone perhaps will have some communal obligations that they contribute to.
Right.
Okay. And then people will have their own capabilities where they can, you know, which communal obligations they can do. So I think as an ideal or theoretical model, it'd be fair to say that everyone has to do their fard ayn, but ideally also everyone should be contributing to the communal obligations. But we have multiple communal obligations, right? The work to political work, political activism, the work to that concerns Islamic governance is not the only communal obligation. Mm-hmm. As you said, we have, and again, concreteness of Islam is important here. What are the challenges facing the Umma now? There are multiple challenges. Some of them will overlap or will have some connection with the work for governance or the work that relates to governance. Some won't.
Right.
But it's got to be done. It's an obligation. It's a communal obligation. So the coming to your question then, the common Muslim needs to work based on their capabilities. And like in all other areas, they will ask the people. If you're not sure, you can ask Imam scholars for guidance on this. But and everyone's, this is why you can't give rules fixed sort of templates here, because everyone's situation is going to be a little bit different. But this is what you want to aim for. You want to aim to make sure that you're fulfilling your personal obligations, and then you're seeing which communal obligations you can contribute to. That's from an individual level. From the Umma level, the religious of thinking as an Umma, we want to make sure that all our communal obligations are being fulfilled.
Okay.
And we don't want this situation where some are left or where some monopolize all the others.
So let me paint a more practical picture here. So you've got like a businessman in the community. He recognizes that there are multiple challenges his community faces. There's an absence of, say, Islamic education. There is an issue with the westernization, let's call it that, of the Muslim community. So he's now thinking, where should I place my money? Where should I practically contribute? Mm-hmm. So he's going to contribute to his local mosque. He's going to develop local seminaries, maybe. He's going to develop organizations that may deal with some of these intellectual challenges that the mm-hmm. Muslim mm-hmm. faces. So he's spreading his money around those activities, and he's actively engaged in a few of them as well, but he can't be doing everything, right?
That's fine.
So he now hears from a person like yourself that, look, also caliphate is an obligation. Yeah. If he said, all right, let me contribute to that first category, those thinkers. I'm not a thinker. I'm a businessman. You know, I'm not here to think about the great philosophical questions and the big sort of systemic questions about economics. But I know that there are some young, really good young students who are capable of thinking in this direction. Why don't I help them by, you know, funding their PhDs or something, mm-hmm. right? Would that be a sufficient enough work from him as an individual for him to say, okay, I've tried my best and I'm doing my obligations to the best of my ability?
Yeah, I don't see why not. Okay. Again, let's think about this in concrete terms. What's the opposite option? What are we comparing this to?
He has to go and talk about the caliphate to everyone.
No.
And...
See, that's okay. Again, okay. If we said the alternative was he has to join the intellectual work.
Yes.
Then we're pushing people and saying everyone has to fit this certain thing, certain mold.
Yeah.
But I think we recognize, as we said, that people have their talents and their abilities and their inclinations, which is the way Allah has created us.
Yeah.
Some people will be much more inclined to the intellectual, the philosophical, the theoretical. Other people are much more hands-on. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly fine as long as we are contributing. And as long as, from an Ummah perspective, the obligations are being duly undertaken. That's okay. The point of sufficiency, right?
Yeah.
Are they sufficiently being undertaken? Because otherwise, what I'm trying to avoid is to say, well, everyone can do whatever they're good at, but then that leaves some things undone. So there doesn't have to be sufficiency.
Yeah.
And that may require, in some cases, people to push themselves to do something they may not otherwise have done. Mm. But in origin, the Ummah's got immense resources, it's got immense talent, it's got immense numbers. Mm. I don't think that we face that problem. Okay. So yes, the businessman who has money to contribute, he can contribute in certain areas and not in other areas, because
right.
that means he'll be putting more in those important things. Now, I think what's important to understand here, when we talk about that third category and lay Muslims or common people, for want of better descriptions, there is a key role that, as an ummah, we want to make sure we have amongst us as a whole.
Mm.
As a collective, which is the correct or the right understanding of Islam as what we described, a comprehensive way of life, and that this is part of it. We definitely want that. What you don't want is, you know, the people who are working in the first couple of buckets are doing their thing, but the ummah as a whole is somewhere else, right? Because it's we're working with and for the ummah.
Okay.
Okay. And so, yes, now that work tease in nicely to the very good work that most of our ulama, most of our Muslim teachers and people are involved in, which is teaching Islam.
Right.
Teaching, living, practicing, breathing Islam. Right? Part of which is fardain, and a lot of it is not fardain. It's the fardain components, and there's fard kifaya components of what's being taught. So This is where I think there is a role for everyone, but it's very basic, right?
Teach,
understanding.
Right.
If you think about it in terms of the objective, Muslims need to, and this is just part of, you know, the understanding Islam properly.
Yeah.
Right. What is the deen at the basic level, and understanding that this is part of it. It's not something auxiliary. It's not something supplementary. Mm. It's not something that if we had to be great, but you know, otherwise things are fine. They're not.
I mean, do you think there is a failing there? I mean, you know, can we describe the caliphate to be a forgotten obligation that there is, you know, in that we're talking about the general sphere, the citizenry, that we don't sufficiently talk about the caliphate this sense?
Yeah, but not only the caliphate.
Yeah.
I think this goes beyond, because of the way things have panned out, because of the fact that secular power has been dominant, we've imbued certain aspects of secular thinkings or liberal, atomistic, individualist thinking.
Right.
Which means that it's not that, I mean, it's not that in the seminaries and elsewhere the communal aspects of Islam are not taught, but it's that they're taught in very theoretical ways. This part of Islam, it was there in the past, here's the history. Okay, but what about today?
Right.
I mean, that link is missing. And this is where I think there needs to be work. And this is where larger subsets of the ummah are involved, both the teachers, the imams, the scholars, but other people being taught, okay? Which is that, and again, let's say the teacher in Al-Azhar has to go, here's the program and here's what we're doing and let's all get involved. Mm-hmm. But there needs to be a connection between the theory and the fact that it's a live obligation, okay? And that can connect up with saying, and look, and here's the people that are doing this. We should support them in whatever way we can.
So we have to keep the caliphate consciousness alive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. The political consciousness of Muslims, caliphate consciousness, whatever name we give it.
Yeah.
But, and really, it's just, I'd rather just make it part of properly understanding what Islam is and it ties into where we started. If this is a pillar, a key part of the deen, which it is, then we can't cut it off when we're teaching Islam. Okay, and so this is how I see. This is how I would see it working. That the imams and scholars that are teaching Islam in the seminaries, in the madaris, in the masajid, in the halaqat, anywhere, are doing a great job, and they're fulfilling a communal obligation.
Mm.
Okay, and so this is how we should be looking at it. You've got these multiple communal obligations, and you want to look at them in a way where they're tied to each other, and they complement each other.
Yeah,
not in a way where there seem to be intention and one comes at the expense of the other.
Well, because there is sometimes this discussion out there that when someone engages in these communal obligations, maybe charity or maybe, studying beyond the basics, Islam, or creating sort of seminaries for mujtahids or for established scholars, that some may suggest that this work is somehow not that important in view of the fact that the caliphate is the mother of all obligations and one needs to worry about this before worrying about, those secondary activities.
Yeah, the problem that exists, and I think that's a problematic way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wrong way of conceptualizing the priority.
Okay.
It's the wrong way of conceptualizing the fundamental importance of the caliphate.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to see when you say that there are other communal obligations. So what do you suggest to the hypothetical interlocutor? Mm. What is being suggested about all the other communal obligations? Yes, all those obligations would be more properly executed in the context of a caliphate.
Yeah.
But you can't just give them up in the proverbial meantime. Right, so I think that's the wrong way to think about it.
Mm.
And why does it need to be thought about in that way in the first place, where, as I said, you can think of the various communal obligations as part of the same, tied together, pearls in the same necklace, if you will, that all work in the same direction. Now, here's the problem. Part of it, I think there is a valid concern there. I don't want to dismiss that entirely. I think there is a wrong way of thinking about it that's behind that type of thinking, but there's also a valid concern because some people doing the charity, doing the teaching, are doing it in a way, same point, where they're putting the two obligations at loggerheads.
Mm-hmm.
So think about the scholar or the imam whose focus is to teach the fundamentals of Islam because he or she sees that Muslims are away from Islam. We've got this wave of, attacks on our fundamentals, whatever. That's now, but we always need the teaching of the fundamentals of Islam. So some scholars focusing on the fundamentals, as they're doing that, when the topic of the caliphate comes up, they dismiss it.
Okay.
It's like, oh, that's not important. We can't do anything about that now. There's a pessimism. There's a learned helplessness. Whatever the cause may be, there are various causes, but they dismiss it. Or the person doing the charity work is doing the charity work. That's great. We need it. But they have a dismissive or a problematic attitude when the topic of the caliphate comes up, as opposed to the idea that we're doing this charity because we need to do it. It's an obligation. People out there are dying. People out there are poor. People out there are orphans. There are widows, et cetera, et cetera. Whilst acknowledging that, yes, all those problems would be ideally and more properly dealt with under a governance, and therefore we need that, and we need people to be working on that.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the same point. Like,
yeah,
you've got these multiple tasks that the Ummah needs to do as an Ummah. The Ummah is vast, vast talent, vast resources, numbers, right? And we can work on these different areas whilst looking at them as complementary and not looking at them as intention at loggerheads. So really, it's how we're going about it, that's either creating the problem or is creating the problem, right? But it can be changed to be done in a way that is better, is more positive.
Usman, after the fall of the caliphate, many Islamic groups were set up to either explicitly or implicitly re-establish the caliphate. So I'm thinking about Ikhwan al-Muslimin, notable thinkers like Hassan al-Banna or Sayyid Qutb, who talked a lot about Islamic rule and the need for eventually the unification of the Muslim world. Sheikh Taqiyuddin Nabhani from Hizb al-Tahrir very explicitly talked about the caliphate as a priority and in many ways probably kept the idea alive in the Muslim world. You've got in Pakistan, Isra Ahmed, and you've got Maududi, of course, who very fundamentally talked about the need for Muslim reunification in many ways, even if it was a long-term aspiration. What can we learn, if anything, from their experiences and their writings?
Well, we've learned a lot. Even before that, I think it's important to point out that the reason a lot of these movements and a lot of these scholars did this work is because they saw the problem firsthand. Mm-hmm. They saw the concrete realities on the ground and what it meant to go from a situation where you had the caliphate or you had Islamic governance of some sort to it's gone. And that's important because sometimes, you know, people who are born in the latter reality don't appreciate the difference that it causes. So these were people who understood this from a theoretical perspective, but also from the practical reality that they faced, and they stood up to do what they could in the situation that they had. And may Allah reward all of them for it. And any work that we do now, that we ought to do now, that people are doing now is standing on their shoulders. And so we ask Allah to reward them for that. And there's something to learn from all of them. And I think what separates a lot of the names that you mentioned is details, approaches, differences in methodology, all of which is important. It's an important discussion, no doubt. But what combines them is the appreciation of the obligation, the appreciation of the task at hand, and the appreciation that this task has to be done. People need to get involved. People need to get to roll their sleeves up, as it were. I think Sheikh Taqiyuddin stands out to the extent that we're talking about the caliphate. Not that the others were not talking about the same referent, if you will, the same concept of Islamic governance.
Yeah.
But to the extent that we're talking more specifically about the caliphate, then definitely an explicit focus, keeping the name alive, keeping the word alive, the theorizing done on that, I think, stands out. And we have a lot to learn from that. Again, however, as I said, what I said about Mawardi and Ibn Khaldun and all the medieval Islamic greats applies to the 20th century heavyweights, if you will, which is that our task is not to copy-paste what they did. It's to engage our reality as they engage theirs. And I think this is where some of the problem occurs, perhaps naturally, perhaps expectedly, because all of these scholars had organized efforts, groups, parties, jama'at, and that there can be a tendency for that towards sort of coalescing, fossilizing around certain principles, certain ideas, and a certain sacralization and a certain quasi sacralization of the founding figures as well can be the case. So we have to be wary of that. But the point is, I think the pitfall that we have to avoid. And that in some cases, to a certain extent, I think all the larger movements have fallen in, is not to do that, is not to go, well, here's the solutions that so-and-so came up in the 1960s and the 1950s, and we're just going to persist with these, right? Rather, it's to appreciate what they did, which is to look at the reality, understand it, figure out what needs to be done, and attempt to do that. Attempt to do that, and as human efforts, there's going to be successes, there's going to be failures.
Correct.
What we need to do is have that critical mindset and go, okay, this is what looks like the successes, this is what looks like the failures. Let's build on the successes, and let's see what we can do about the failures, knowing that we too will fail. We too will, right? So there is, again, that tendency, humans, we do this where it's like, you know, so-and-so, and this is not just 20th century Islamist movements.
Yeah.
This is across the board, right? Think about the theological, the manhaji movements, right? This idea, whether it be Salafi movements, Sufi movements, the idea that everyone got it wrong for after this scholar came up, Ibn Taymiyyah came up, or Al-Ghazali came up, and he sorted everything out.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and now we're taking this forward. So I think two phenomena take place. One is this fossilization, this pseudo quasi sacralization of certain figures, who then become almost infallible. Right, except that because you can't say that explicitly. So you say, oh yeah, they had these small mistakes, but otherwise they were great. And then when you adopt it, somehow you become quasi infallible. Right, we have to humanize and say that, and you know, not only play nominal service to the saying of Imam Malik that everyone's saying is taken and rejected except the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, except the person in this grave in Masjid al-Nabawi. If that's true, if we truly believe that, then that's going to be the case. So every person is going to have successes, have failures. We build on the successes, we learn from the failures, and we know that we're going to make mistakes ourselves. So we be prepared for that, and it's a constant effort to do our best and to rely on Allah Ta'ala, who is the one who guide us to the victory that He's promised.
Yeah.
Ummah.
Uthman, we're here in Istanbul because we're attending this week the Ummatics Conference, and I know you are a senior member, if I can say that, of the Ummatics Institute. Tell me, what's your aim? Why are you meeting here in Istanbul, and what's the flavor of the conference that we're about to attend?
The Ummatics project, which I'm a part of, I contribute to that.
Yeah,
modest contribution. The project started a couple of years ago. It's one effort amongst what we hope will be multiple efforts that focus on these issues.
Yeah.
Of the Ummah, of Muslims being able to first of all think as Muslims with our own categories, with our own thoughts, with our own, instead of always responding, being on the back foot, being reactionary, or merely taking foreign categories as given for us. And so the name Ummatics is trying to do that as an example. But yeah, we're trying to think about these issues, various projects and initiatives have been done in the last 2 years, and this is our first conference. The idea of the conference is to bring together experts, scholars, to start thinking about these various issues. So in other words, that first bucket that I described, we're trying to focus on that area, and we need focused efforts as well.
Yeah.
We don't need jack of all trades type. We need specialization, we need focus. So we're focusing in this area, and this particular conference is looking at these issues, the nation state. How do we overcome the nation state? How do we think about the nation state? How do we think about a post-nation state era in which, how do we conceptualize Islamic governance beyond the nation state? And so we've, alhamdulillah, there are 40 or 50 presenters that are coming from different parts of the world. We've chosen Istanbul. We want to do this in the Muslim world, and this is one of the areas where a lot of good work is happening. There's a symbolic significance with Istanbul, previously Constantinople. It's always been very, very significant. It's taking forward a very important conversation that we hope will be built on to contribute and take forward that work of really thinking seriously, creatively, seriously, critically about what does Islamic governance look like in the 21st century.
We've waited 100 years with the absence of a central authority, a caliphate, we have to wait another 100 years before a caliphate is realizable.
Allahu alam, if it's another 100, if it's 20, if it's 50, if it's 200, we don't know. And in fact, that type of sort of forecasting could be part of the work that people think about in a serious way, not I mean forecasting where, you know, we tend to do around lunch and dinner off the top of our heads. But there is, you know, there's serious work that happens in the academy under the title of future studies, where there are serious projections and various political regimes and leaders do this work. That's an important area. But nevertheless, I think the Islamic tradition is more about really trying to understand what our obligations are and putting our best foot forward to do them. But there's not too much I think we can put in the basket of how long it might take.
Right.
I do think that it will be a while. There is a lot of work to be done. Notwithstanding that the efforts we spoke about earlier have been significant. A lot of work has been done since 1924.
Yes.
But a lot of work remains, and I think our focus needs to be on understanding the obligation, assisting the Ummah more generally in understanding it so that more people can be involved in the efforts, those who have the capabilities, and really to put our best foot forward for that, and leaving the rest as it is to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Osman Badr, it's been really a fascinating interview. Jazakallah khair for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's an honor and privilege to have this discussion.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.